your Bibles up to the Old Testament book of Esther. It's where we're going to be tonight, in the book of Esther. So you find your way there, I'll find my way there. I forgot to mark my spot, but we'll find it here in a second. All right, we're going to be in Esther chapter 5 tonight. Esther chapter 5. Also, we're going to be partaking of communion, just so that you know that, in case there's some things that you need to get right with the Lord tonight. I would really encourage you to do that. Spend some time just asking the Lord to reveal anything in your life that needs to be taken away or cleansed or forgiven for, or you need to repent of. Tonight's a great night to do that. Tonight, Esther chapter 5, and we're going to try to do chapter 6. We come this evening to one of the most, if you ask me at least, drama-filled and interesting stories in the Scriptures. And it's a story about the faithfulness and the love of God. It's a story about the pursuing and the persistent love of God. It's a story about the providence of God working in the lives of the people that He actually chose and that He loves. And that is the nation of Israel. Even when they may not have seen it or been fully aware of it, God was still working in their lives. Now, I guarantee you guys that when we meet the Lord, and if the Lord does show us our entire lives, I don't know how it's going to be on the day of the judgment of the Bema Seat for Christians. Not sure how all that's going to go, but if the Lord does in fact show us our lives, I can guarantee you there's going to be lots and lots of times when we did not see God's hand, we did not realize God was working, but God was indeed working, and we were probably just unaware of it. I think that happens to us a lot, especially as we go through life sort of oblivious to what God might be doing. We're just going through our everyday stuff, and God's at work, and we don't even realize it. So that's what it was like for the nation of Israel. Now, I think that that ought to be an encouragement to most of us because, in all honesty, the nation of Israel wasn't being faithful at this time. Yet God was still working on their behalf. They were in captivity, and they had stayed in captivity, many of them, by choice. We'll talk about that in a second. But we see here that most of the people that He's working on behalf of, in all honesty, were pretty lukewarm when it came to their faith. Yet, God was still at work. And I think it's neat to know that in spite of us, in spite often of our own lukewarmness, our own lack of maybe faithfulness to God, God still remains faithful. God is very persistent, and God has a pursuing love. As 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 13 says, "If we are faithless, He will remain faithful, for He cannot disown Himself." Now, a lot of what we learn about God in dealing with the nation of Israel is that God was faithful to the covenant that He had made with the nation of Israel. God was faithful to the Word and to His promises. Now, in the case of the book of Esther, that's exactly what we see happening. The Jewish people had put themselves in a very bad way by disobeying their part of the covenant of God, by turning away from God to idolatry, by hardening their hearts, by stiffening their necks, by closing their ears to God as He was trying to get through to them. Over and over and over, God had tried to get through to them. He had attempted to get through to them by His love and His mercy and His grace. But in spite of Him sending the prophets one after another, calling them to repentance, warning them that they needed to repent, trying to correct them, trying to even rebuke them, they rejected God's voice, and they rejected God's love, and they rejected God's mercy. And so God had been patient with them for years and years and years. In fact, when we looked at the northern kingdom of Israel, then the southern kingdom of Judah, it took a long time, especially for the southern kingdom of Judah, before they finally went into captivity. But they had been blowing it for quite a while before He finally removed His protecting hand from them and allowed them to be overcome and to be taken into captivity by their enemies. That's what happened. And so the reason that the Jews are in Persia, as we look at this portion of Scripture, is because they were reaping what they had sown. They were reaping the consequences of their sin. And I think that's an important thing to think about when you decide, if I make the decision, well, I'm going to go ahead and do this thing that I know is wrong, I know is sinful, and then you do it anyways. Remember that there's the aftermath. There's the reaping of the consequences. There's the bitter consequences. I've had people over the years sitting in my office weeping because of stuff and choices that they had made over maybe a period of time, and they knew it was wrong, and now they were saying, Pastor Joseph, they're crying, they're saddened, they're broken, and they're basically saying, I know I'm under the discipline of God and God's hand is upon me because I've been sinning, and they're sort of telling me, could you please stop God from giving me a spanking? And I'm like, I'm not going to mess with that, right? It's like, if the Lord's disciplining you, who am I to get in the way? And I mean, I've been there myself where the Lord has disciplined me because of disobedience. So we see that it's God's faithful love and mercy that even brings us to a place where He would discipline us. That's another thing that we should always remember, that God disciplines those that He loves. He chastises everyone that He considers to be sons and daughters. So, they're in Persia. Hundreds of thousands of them, probably 1 million to 2 million, are still left in Persia. Only 50 to 60,000 had gone back to Judah to rebuild the city and to rebuild the walls and to rebuild the temple. But the majority of the people had stayed there in the comfort of the world. And Babylon is where they were at first, but then Persia took over. So they're in Persia, they're in Babylon. They're, and that's a picture of the world. They were comfortable in the world. They really didn't have a heart for the things of God. Otherwise, they would have gone back to their land where their temple was. But these people were comfortable to stay there. They had become spiritually complacent. So in my mind, what we're reading here in this story, in the book of Esther, is not only a wake-up call, but it's also a reminder to the Jews of how much they really needed God. And so let me give you our setting again. Our setting, just to kind of get us back up to speed, Xerxes, or if you have, I think the NIV calls him Xerxes, Ahasuerus is his name here, same different language usage there, but this king, he wanted a new queen because Vashti had sort of dissed him to his buddies. And so he wanted a new queen, so God, providentially, without the king even realizing what was happening, raised up this beautiful young Jewish girl named Esther to be the new queen for the king. And he picked her, even though he picked her, God chose her. And God sent her. Now in the meantime, we saw in the story that a wicked man named Haman was also raised up by the king to be the prime minister. He was in the second highest seat under the king in the land. Now, he ended up having it out, we saw, for Mordecai. Mordecai was Esther's uncle. He had raised her because her parents had passed away. And so Mordecai and Esther were Jewish. But because Mordecai would not bow down or pay homage to Haman, when Haman walked by, he had made a rule, because he was second in command, that everybody had to bow down before him. But Mordecai wouldn't do it. So Haman became filled with bitterness because of his pride and because of his ego being pricked. He was angered. And we've heard this before. I mentioned it before. But you know, when the ego is pricked, it releases a powerful poison. And ego is a dangerous thing. Now, we all have one. But the bigger it is, the more dangerous it is. And so his ego gets pricked because of Mordecai not bowing down before him. And so Haman was extremely angered by this. Haman's focus, as we've seen, was all about himself, inflating his own ego. And so when Mordecai wouldn't bow and pay him homage, we saw that he became enraged. He became incensed. He became infuriated. Now at first, he decided it wasn't enough just to get rid of Mordecai. He knew that Mordecai was Jewish. He wanted to go further than that. And so he decided to devise a plan in order to destroy all of the Jews that were living in the land of Persia. Now, Satan was behind this, obviously, behind this anti-Semitic attack. And Satan has tried many times to try his best to destroy the nation of Israel, the Jewish people. And this was just another one of those tries. And so, remember, he manipulated the king, and he went before the king, and he offered the king a ton of money, somewhere in the vicinity of $30 million in our money. And he made this deal with the king that all the Jews would be killed on one day. All the Jews in the kingdom would be wiped out in one day, totally annihilated and totally eliminated for no reason except for his hatred for Mordecai and then wanting to punish his people. Now, what becomes very apparent is Haman was fighting more than just Mordecai. That's what we start to see in the story. Yes, he hated Mordecai with all of his guts. However, he was fighting against more than just Mordecai. He was fighting against more than just the Jews. What he was in essence doing is Haman had picked a fight with God. And that's always a bad idea when a person picks a fight with God. The Jews, even though, and people still, I saw some people talking about the Jews today, and people rip into the Jews. They're always mad at the Jews, and they're always criticizing the Jews. Whether we like it or not, the nation of Israel, the Jewish people, are God's chosen people. They are the apple of His eye. They haven't stopped being that, and we, the church, haven't replaced them. We're simply grafted into them. But there's a spiritual law that cannot be overcome or altered, and it's this, that no one fights against God and wins. Now, we might say, well, what was up with God? You know, Haman was picking a fight really with God. Well, he was picking a fight with God because he was picking a fight with or messing with God's people. And when you mess with God's people, you mess with God. You know, remember when Saul was persecuting the church, the early church, and he was going and having Christians arrested, put into prison, and then even put to death. He's on his road to Damascus with permission or with a warrant, basically, from the Sanhedrin to go to Damascus, which was a long ways from Israel. It was in Syria, to find Christians, hunt them down, bring them back to Damascus, have them punished, and maybe even killed. That was Saul, his heart, to persecute the church. And on his way there is when he met Jesus. And Jesus blinded him and knocked him down. One time I said he knocked him off of his horse. And then one of the ladies in the church said, I don't see a horse in the story. And so I got rebuked. So he knocked him down and somehow he fell to the ground. I don't know if it was off a horse, off a donkey, off a camel, or just walking. But he got knocked down. Okay? Cover all the bases. Maybe he was riding his dog. I don't know. Anyway, he got knocked down. So he's blinded. But here's what the Lord says to him. He says, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? Who was Saul persecuting? He was persecuting the Christians. He was persecuting the Lord's church, God's people. And so even here we see that Haman decides to try to destroy God's people. And so to attack God's people is to pick a fight with God who loves His people. Now you as a Christian, there's going to be times when you will come under attack. This happens quite a bit. Some of you don't realize, but it happens quite a bit to us as a church, to me as a pastor at times. But you know, there's a really cool verse, there's a promise given to us in the New Testament. I think it's in the book of Romans or Corinthians, I can't remember. But it says this, the insults of those who insult you have fallen on me, the Lord says. So when we Christians get attacked or we get insulted or even persecuted, ultimately they are fighting against and picking a fight with God. That's what's kind of cool. So he says, the insults of those who insult you, the people of God, the church, God says have fallen on me. Now Mordecai and all the Jews, when they heard about this decree, because it was a decree that went throughout the land, it was an official decree. It had the king's stamp of approval on it because the king was deceived into it. When they heard about the decree, what the Jews did is they humbled themselves. They began to weep. Now what's interesting is God is never mentioned in this book. It doesn't say they wept and they sought God. It just says that they began to wear sackcloth and ashes, and they humbled themselves. Now, obviously, in my mind, they were being awakened to their need for God. Their desperate circumstances brought them to that realization. Now, sadly, often, the way it works with us humans, us in this room even, it often takes something drastic or tragic for God to remind us of our desperate need for Him. And I've seen this probably, I don't know, in 38 years of walking with Jesus and hearing testimony after testimony after testimony. And by the way, we're going to have a really neat testimony next Thursday. I mentioned in the first service, I didn't mention it, I don't think in the second, I might have. This last week we met this really neat kid there in Belen that was in a wheelchair. He was in the military in a wheelchair. He's in a wheelchair now. He's paralyzed from the waist down. He's going to come and he's going to be here next Thursday to share with our high schoolers, and then he's going to share with us his testimony. And it's just a powerful story of what God had to do to get his attention. But often, that's what happens, is we are oblivious to what God is doing. Then something tragic happens and we get awoken to our spiritual need. Now, it's sad that it takes that to happen for a lot of people. I think it'd be better if we just sought God first. We didn't have to wait till some tragedy happened to try to seek the Lord. But I've seen it happen so many times. People fall into complacency. People fall into apathy spiritually. And then something happens and they get awakened by a tragedy, and they go from apathy and complacency to fervently seeking God and fervently calling upon God. Desperately petitioning and seeking and pursuing God for help. I've seen this happen many times with marriages. People have been married for a long time. They start to take each other for granted, and pretty soon, you know, there's neglect and there's no communication. And then one of the people in the marriage decides, you know what, I'm sick of this. I don't want to be married anymore. I don't even love this person. This person doesn't love me. And they decide, I'm just going to get a divorce. And all of a sudden, wow, the other person wakes up. I've seen this many times and come into my office. Pastor Joseph, can you talk to my husband? Can you talk to my wife? They're going to leave me. Like, what happened? Well, I never talked to them for the last 2 years and they're mad at me now. Or whatever. You know, it's like, well, now you woke up. You know? And this happens. This kind of stuff happens a lot. And so, you know, a lot of people, they don't have time for God. Because they're so self-occupied or preoccupied with self. They become comfortable in their lives. They're self-absorbed, they're cozy, and they don't recognize their need for God. And I think that's what really had happened when the people were living there in the world, in Babylon or in Persia. They were comfortable there. And sadder still is when God does answer. And this happens a lot too. I've seen this happen a few times. God answers their desperate cry. And everything turns around. And pretty soon what happens? They forget about God again, and they go back to their old ways, back to the same old, and God is forgotten. They remembered God in the midst of tragedy or the midst of their trial or their suffering, and then when everything is past, they go back to what they were doing. And they forget all about God again. The nation of Israel did that many times, but I've seen people do that in our day as well. Now lastly, to get up to speed, Esther, the queen, now when she hears about the tragic decree that has been given, she's challenged by Mordecai, her uncle, sort of her dad, to do something about it in order to save the Jewish people. And she knew that she couldn't just walk into the king, because the way it worked in Persia, the king had to call you into his presence. If you just showed up and walked in, and he didn't extend scepter, yes. Thank you. The scepter, if he didn't extend the scepter to you, you were dead. They'd kill you right on the spot. So, even though it was his wife, and she was the queen, she knew this. But she also understood, as Mordecai said, perhaps God has put you in this place for such a time as this. He wanted her to realize that. And so she decided to go into the presence of the king, even If it cost her her life, she was going to take action. Look at verse 16 and verse 17 of chapter 4. Notice it says, she says, "Go gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise. And so I will go to the king, which is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." So Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther commanded him. Now, what I see now is the soil has been prepared through prayer. Guys, when you're facing adversity or difficulty or something that you don't know what the outcome is going to be, it is smart, it is wise to get on your knees and begin to seek God and cry out to God. That's what they did. So the soil's prepared, and now the time, it's ripe for God to work. The soil's been prepared because everyone is on the same page. They're all seeking the Lord. They're humbled before God. They realize they're needy and they're desperate. They're fasting and they're praying. They're obviously seeking His help. And now God is really going to do some awesome stuff on their behalf. Guys, when you pray, pray in faith and expect awesome stuff. But when you pray, also be willing to act. Be willing to do whatever God tells you to do. See, at times, it's not just enough to pray. We have to be willing to pray and act. And great prayers are great, but we must also be willing to act with great deeds of faith. And that's what she did. She said, "I need your guys' prayers. Fast and pray for these 3 days, because I'm going to go into the king's presence, and I don't want to die. I want to go in there and be successful." And so she asked for prayer, but she was going to go in and take a big step of faith. So in this case, yes, they needed to pray, but they also needed someone to act. James 2:20 says this, "Faith without works or faith without deeds is dead." So if someone didn't do something at this point, all of the Jews were going to be dead. So Esther puts her faith now into action. She prepares herself spiritually first, and then she prepared herself physically. Now, she knows she's going to go before the queen. I can imagine that she really got beautified and dolled right up, because she wanted her husband to look at her and go, "Woo, come on in, babe." You know how men are. And so she made herself beautiful. And so remember, think about this though. Esther was the one that the king picked of all of the most beautiful women throughout the land. There were like 130 provinces. They had brought all of these beautiful women, and Esther was the cream of the crop. So the king picked her. He loved her. He wanted her. So she's a beautiful, beautiful woman, and the Lord made her beautiful. And so all of this was God's hand. Right? And so look at chapter 5 now. We come to our story of that long introduction. It says, "Now it happened on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace, across from the king's house, while the king sat on his royal throne in the royal house, facing the entrance of the house. So it was, when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, that she found favor in his sight. And the king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther went near and touched the top of the scepter." Then, it's verse 3, "And the king said to her, 'What do you wish, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given to you up to half the kingdom.'" Now, I would say at this point, everything is going pretty good, don't you think? It all was all working. The prayers are being answered. The king offers her the scepter. He doesn't kill her on the spot. He invites her to come into his presence. But not only that, it's neat what happens here. What's said. Now, for her, this was not just for her, remember. She was doing this for, not just for Mordecai, she was doing this for the whole nation. So I'm sure that for her, when she first came into the courtyard there, and the king saw her, and their eyes met, I'm sure at that moment there was a lot of tension in her heart. She's taking this huge step of faith, putting her life on the line, but not just for her life, it was for the fate of the entire Jewish nation. So there was a lot riding on this. Now remember Haman was the one that set this whole thing up. He's an evil man, and he was used by Satan. Guys, understand, God uses people, but Satan still uses people as well. So Haman, you know, he had his plan, and his plan was to get rid of and to kill all of these people. Now, what's neat here is what the Lord does and how the king responds. And notice he says to her in verse 3, this is amazing. And the king said to her, "What do you wish, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given to you up to half the kingdom." Now that's, if you think about that, that's an amazing thing that the king just tells her. You can have anything you want, Esther, up to half of the kingdom. So, she does not immediately respond. Because she has to have wisdom in how she's going to pull this thing off. Because Haman had put this plan into place, and it was also a law. And so, he's trying to eliminate, just like Hitler did, trying to eliminate the Jews. But here again we see the providence of God, the favor of God, working on behalf of the Jewish people. In the book of Proverbs chapter 21 verse 1, there's a really neat verse there. It says this, "The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord. He directs it like a water course wherever he pleases." We're going to be talking about Romans chapter 13 this Sunday. And one of the points I'm going to bring out in Romans chapter 13, just to give you a little foretaste, is that God raises up and brings down kings. He's sovereign over nations. He's sovereign over kingdoms. And so here God directs this king's heart and gives favor to Esther. Now Ahasuerus, or Xerxes, as he sees this gorgeous wife, all decked out, standing in the court, invites her in now. And I don't know if you've ever been in a situation when you've prayed and you don't know. You don't know which way it's going to go. And then when it does finally go your way, there's this sigh of relief. And I'm sure for her, I'm sure her blood pressure was way up there. And then now he gives her this favor. And I'm sure inside she was like, "Whew, all right, step one is passed. I'm good. I'm not going to die. The king is asking me what I want, and he wants to give me up to half the kingdom." I can't tell you how many times, you know, when you're seeking the Lord and you're praying and you don't know what's going to happen, and then the Lord intervenes. I can't tell you how many times in my own life, I've been saying, "Lord, thank you. Thank you that turned out well. It could have turned out bad, Lord, but it turned out wonderful. Thank you for the answered prayer." And this must have been how Esther felt. And so she's passed this first hurdle. But now, she has to figure out next how to tell the king. First of all, he doesn't even know yet that she's Jewish. And she doesn't know that Haman's evil plan, the king doesn't know that Haman's evil plan was to get rid of her and all of the Jews. That plan had to be thwarted, but it was also already put into law. So she needed wisdom. She needed God's intervention. You know, there's a great promise given to us in the New Testament in the book of James chapter 1. It says, if any of you lack wisdom, you should ask God. And God gives generously and freely to those that ask Him. But we should ask in faith, not doubting. Guys, there's a lot of times that we really need wisdom from the Lord. Lord, I don't know what to say. I don't know what to do. Lord, I need your wisdom. And so that's what she needed. And so she has that good start in verse 3. Now, she doesn't come out, like I said, right away and say it. Again, I believe this was the providence of God putting on her heart to wait for the right time and God's timing. So let's keep going and see what happens next in this story. Look at verse 4. So Esther answered, "If it pleases the king, let the king and Haman come today to the banquet that I have prepared for him." Then the king said, "Bring Haman quickly, that he may do as Esther has said." So the king and Haman went to the banquet that Esther had prepared. At the banquet of wine, the king said to Esther, What is your petition? It shall be granted you. What is your request? Up to half the kingdom, it shall be done. Then, now remember, Haman doesn't know yet that Esther's about to throw him under the bus, right? He thinks, hey, look, the queen likes me. She invited me to a banquet, right? Verse 7, then Esther answered and said, my petition and request is this. If I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfill my request, then let the king and Haman come to the banquet which I will prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king has said. So she doesn't say it right then. They just have a good time together. And they're just enjoying the meal, enjoying the wine and all of that. And she goes, but I want to have a banquet and I want you guys to come to my banquet tomorrow again. So Haman went out that day joyful and with a glad heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai, let's picture this, right? He just got to be totally like, Haman's all about himself. He's all about popularity. He's all about having people like him, having people pay homage to him. And now he gets this great blessing in his mind that the queen invites him to two banquets in a row. He's on cloud nine, right? He's all excited. It says that he left that day with a joyful and a glad heart. I'm sure he couldn't wait to get home to brag about it. We'll see how he's a bragger here in a little bit. He wants to brag to everybody that he's been exalted to this great place. But notice what happens on the way out. So he's coming out from the presence of the king and the queen, and he's coming out with a glad heart. It says, but when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, and that he did not stand or tremble before him, he was filled with indignation against Mordecai. So all of a sudden his ego gets pricked again, and he's mad as heck. Because Mordecai is still defying him. Right? Verse 10, nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home. He was so mad he probably wanted to do something, but he held his temper and he went home. And he sent and he called for his friends and his wife, Zeresh. Zeresh. It's an interesting name. Then Haman told them of his great riches, the multitude of his children. Now remember, Haman, he had offered the king some 30 million bucks. And so he was a very, very wealthy man. He was bragging about his wealth. The multitude of his children had lots and lots of kids. And back in that culture, the more kids you had, the better, right? And that's how they looked at it. And everything in which the king had promoted him, he was telling about all of his great, his place, his status, his promotions, all of that. He's bragging. And how he had advanced him above the officials and servants of the king. And how he was now the second in command, near the top, almost the top dog, right? So he's bragging to all of his friends and his family. Verse 12, moreover, Haman said, besides, Queen Esther invited no one but me to come in with the king to the banquet that she prepared. And tomorrow I am again invited by her, along with the king. So he's just, boy, he is so filled with excitement and pride and arrogance, and his ego is just getting puffed up. But there's that little thorn, right? That little thorn called Mordecai. Yet, all this avails me nothing. So as long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. It's like that one little thing. It like took away all of his focus and all of his joy, and he had all of these great things going, but that darn Mordecai, he made me mad again. He just sat there. He didn't bow down when I came by. Then his wife, Zeresh, and all his friends said to him, let a gallows be made 50 cubits high, and in the morning suggest to the king that Mordecai be hanged on it. Then go merrily with the king to the banquet. And the thing pleased Haman, so he had a gallows made. So it's this day, the next day he's going to this next banquet, but they say you should overnight have this giant gallows built so that you can hang Mordecai and get the permission from the king just to hang him. So he has this thing built. He's got power. These guys work, I'm sure, all night long working, trying to build this big old gallows so he can get Mordecai hanged on it. And so now we come to chapter 6. Now, the thing about pride, I want to say something about pride and bragging before we move on. I don't know who said this, but I like the fact that they said it. Bragging is the only known disease that makes everyone sick except for the person who has it. I like that. And it's like, look at me, look at all that I've done, look at all that I've got. He had the eye disease. And so his big old ego is hurt now. And we come to chapter 6, and he's had this big old gallows built. And let's see what happens. Chapter 6. That night the king could not sleep. Now this is cool, because there's these two parallel things happening. Haman's planning the demise of Mordecai on the gallows the next morning. He's going to have the king give him permission to have Mordecai hanged. But that night, God is at work. It says that night the king could not sleep. No reason. Doesn't tell us why. Doesn't say he was troubled. Whatever. He just couldn't sleep. You ever had a night where you can't sleep? I have those sometimes. I had one the other night, and I just kind of couldn't sleep. And nothing was really bothering me or anything. Whenever I have those nights, I always just think, well, what can I pray about? You know, who can I pray for? And I try to pass my time awake by praying in the middle of the night. And so here, though, the king couldn't sleep, but he's not a Christian. So it says no one. So they say, so one was commanded to bring the book of the records of the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. So he was bored. He couldn't sleep. He goes, hey, get the record of the Chronicles and bring them in here and read them to me. I want to hear what's happened during my reign, during my time of being the king. I want to, because they kept records of everything. So he just has them read to him. And it was found written that Mordecai had told of Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, the doorkeepers who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. Now, you guys remember earlier in the book when we read that these two guys were planning to assassinate the king. Mordecai overheard them talking by the gate. So he put the finger on them. And it came out that yes, they indeed were going to kill the king. So the king has them put to death. But when that happened, nothing good came to Mordecai. There was no reward, nothing. And so now it's in the Chronicles. He's reading about it, right? It says, then the king said, what honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? And the king's servants who attended him said, nothing has been done for him. So the king's thinking, man, here's this guy, Mordecai, good guy. He's a great guy. I love this. You know, here's Haman going to bring Mordecai before the king to have him killed because he hates him. And the king's thinking, this Mordecai is a fine fella. He saved my life, you know. This is great. And so, what's been done for him? We should reward him, the king's saying. Verse 4, so the king said, who is in the court? So now it's morning. Night has passed. They've been reading the Chronicles to him. Guess who shows up first thing in the morning? Because he's going to get rid of Mordecai, right? He says, who's in the court? Now Haman had just entered the court, the outer court of the king's palace, to suggest that the king hang Mordecai on the gallows that he had prepared for him. The king's servant said to him, Haman is here, standing in the court. And the king said, let him come on in. It's his second in command. It's his buddy. They're going to a banquet today at Esther's house, you know, or Esther's palace. And so he let him come on in. So Haman came in and the king started talking. And the king says to him, he asked him, hey, Haman, what shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honor? Now Haman thought in his heart, who would the king delight to honor more than me? He's thinking, he's talking about me. Because remember, everything's about Haman, right? He's got the eye disease, the me disease. And so he's thinking the world revolves around himself, right? And so he's like, well, surely he's talking about honoring me, and he's asking how the person that should be honored should be honored. So he said, what can we do to honor this person? And so he thinks, well, it's me. And then Haman answered, this makes me laugh, because have you ever heard what Jesus or the Bible tells us? Do to others as you would have them do to you. Well, this is not what Haman wanted, but we're going to see what happens here. And Haman answered the king, for the man whom the king delights to honor, thinking it's himself, right? Let a royal robe be brought which the king has worn, and a horse on which the king has ridden, which has a royal crest placed on its head. Then let this robe and horse be delivered to the hand of the one the king most, one of the king's most noble princes, that he may array the man whom the king delights to honor. He goes, so here's what you got to do, king. This guy deserves to be brought out into the public and on your horse even, and your royal robes, and he needs to be paraded through the streets. This is what you should do for this guy, thinking it's himself, right? Then parade him on horseback through the city square and proclaim before him, thus shall it be done to the man to whom the king delights to honor. So he's got this. Haman comes up with the whole plan, the whole speech, everything. He came up with two plans that night. One, to hang Mordecai on giant gallows, and now to have, thinking it's himself, honored, but he's going to find out it's not him here in a second. Then the king said to Haman, you know, I'm paraphrasing, that's a great idea. The king said to Haman, hurry, take the robe and the horse, as you have suggested, and do so for Mordecai. I wish I could see his face at that moment. But he goes in there, he's there to have Mordecai killed. And now, he makes a plan to have Mordecai exalted, right? He goes, everything that you've just described, I want you to do it. Because you're my top guy. You're the prince that I want to you know, take Mordecai and have him exalted. He says, so do for Mordecai the Jew who sits within the king's gate. Leave nothing undone of all that you have spoken. Man, this story is so great. They should make a movie out of it. Have they? They have. Oh, I need to watch it. All right. Verse 11. So, I wonder if it's on Netflix. No, just kidding. All right. So Haman took the robe. And, now this must have been as humiliating and painful as possibly could have ever been for anyone, right? Haman hates Mordecai. But now he has to obey his own stupid plan that he thought was going to be for himself, to exalt himself. So Haman took the robe and the horse, arrayed Mordecai, and led him on horseback through the city square, and proclaimed before him. So he had to say it himself with his own lips. Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Afterward, Mordecai went back to the king's gate. But Haman hurried to his house, mourning and with his head covered. He is so humiliated, like as much as possibly could happen, right? He has just been, he's gotten a real big dose of his own medicine. Verse 13. When Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him, you remember the last time he came home, he was all bragging and telling everybody how great he was and all the great things that had happened. Now he comes home totally like a dog with his, you know, tail between his legs. And he's in mourning. His head's covered. And now he tells his friends and his wife what happened. And his wise men and wives, his wife Zeresh said to him, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish descent, you will not prevail against him, but will surely fall before him. And I'm paraphrasing, his wife says, "You are dead meat, honey." This is what she told him. "You're in huge trouble." Mordecai is exalted. You exalted him. The king has exalted him. And now you want to kill him? He said, and his wife's like, "This is not going good for you, honey." And so, verse 14, while they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs came and hastened to bring Haman to the banquet which Esther had prepared. Now, we're going to end there. I was going to continue on, but we're going to do communion. And I was going to go to the next chapter, but we'll leave that kind of hanging for, it's going to be 2 weeks, but because next week we're going to have that young guy come and share his testimony. But you can read ahead. It's really cool what happens. Well, sort of cool. Not for him. Not for Haman. It's cool for Mordecai. but anyway, it's a great story. It's a great story. But it goes to show you, you know, when you have bitterness and hatred in your heart, usually it's going to turn out bad for you. Especially when you are seeking to harm someone or revenge on someone that doesn't deserve it. Mordecai didn't deserve that. And yet he wanted to have him killed and all the Jews killed. And basically, like I said a while ago, he picked a fight with God. Now, what I wanted to do in relating this to communion tonight is guess who has it out for you? Someone has it out for you and wants you to be taken out. But we have one who has come on our behalf, and his name is Jesus. He's come on our behalf to stand for us, to literally bear a cross for us and to die for us. But the devil wanted to take us out. He wanted to kill us. He wanted us punished. You know, Satan hates your guts and has a horrible plan for your life. Bottom line. God loves you and has a wonderful plan for your life. Bottom line. And so for us as Christians, we can rejoice that God has provided and made a way for us. Even though the enemy wanted to destroy us, he sent his son to rescue us from the devil's dastardly plan that we could be delivered. And so thank the Lord, guys, that Jesus came to save us from ourselves, from our sin, from destruction, from judgment, from ultimately standing before God as his enemy and being condemned. Jesus came to deliver us from that and to give us forgiveness of sins and life everlasting as a gift. And boy, I don't know about you, but every time I think about that, which I think about it all the time, I'm very thankful. Every time I come before the Lord and I have to confess a sin and I realize that my sin was placed on Jesus and he paid the debt of that sin so I would never have to be punished or ever have to be condemned because Jesus took it and he died for me, I'm so thankful. And so we remember tonight in communion what the Lord has done. So the worship team is going to come up and we'll partake of communion together this evening as we remember the great mercy that the Lord has shown us and that we were supposed to die on the gallows, if you will, and Jesus came and rescued us and he died in our place.